Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on KHOI Radio. Hi, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
Well, we've talked about rose geraniums before, but there's also violets. If you get out there early in the spring, gather violets. They're lovely to add just about anything. You can eat the violet leaves, too, at this time of the year. And there's nasturtiums, but that comes a little later in the season.
Well, I just planted my seeds, and they're popping up. Now, nasturtiums, you can eat both the leaves and the flowers, and predominantly they're orange, but they come in other colors, too, reds, yellows, and they're kind of spicy, almost like a radish. A little bit of heat, but not too much. And they're very useful for lots of things. What else? Oh, borage. I just put my borage seeds in. They make these little tiny kind of star-shaped blue flowers that are wonderful on desserts. They don't have a truly amount of flavor, but they're so beautiful, and they're quite edible. The leaves also are edible.
Yeah, that's another mid-season thing, or midsummer thing. You talk about, I've never eaten pineapple sage flowers. The pineapple sage I am familiar with as a wonderful, wonderful herb in the garden. It's a sagey sort of thing, but it has a sweet, sweet undertone. But the flowers, who knew? The flowers.
They have these tiny, gorgeous little red flowers, and they're very few in number, so it would be quite a delicacy. But, you can, they have that same sweet-ish kind of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pluck them. You can put them in salads, but there's usually so few that it's almost a waste of it. But they make a gorgeous garnish if you happen to have some. Let's see. What else do we – oh, roses, of course. Rose petals. Unsprayed. Everybody must remember, don't eat them if they've been sprayed with some kind of difficult thing.
Some things come up in quantity, and they're very edible. The flowers that come on the top of – mustard, of horseradish, of
arugula when it flowers.
Arugula when it flowers.
Chive flowers.
All those things just burst, and not only are they pretty, but you can eat them too.
And they often taste, of course, like the flower, or the plant that they've come off, like the mustard, little yellow mustard flowers are very, have that mustard heat. The arugula flowers have that slight bitter bite that the arugula mm-hmm. has. And of course, chive flowers, those little purple pom-poms taste like onion flavored.
Yes. Get out there and nibble around. You'd be surprised what you can eat out there.
Oh, you know, my horseradish plant is blooming right now. And I've been eating the fresh young leaves, just tearing them up into salads. And the flowers, I just nip the top off and throw them in, too. And they're very pretty.
See? So we eat with our eyes and eat with our mouths, too. I found one more thing I want to mention. On the market, I noticed in seed catalogs a couple of years ago is something called a rat tail radish. And who would think? Who would think? It's a radish.
It's like
radish.
A rat tail. Oh, there's a rat tail comb, too.
That's a rat tail. I don't think you can't eat the comb. No.
But that is a rat tail. That's a. Besides just the tail of the rat.
The rat tail radish is an amazing plant. It's a radish underneath, nothing very fancy. It comes up and makes a radish
like
flower.
Like a red radish.
Kind of a longish red radish.
Oh, okay.
But you can eat that. It comes up and makes flowers. That's fine. That's good, too. But the rat tail is the seed pod that comes off of the flower. And it is sort of a little long rat tail, and it's very radishy. These little pods come off of it. So that's not really a flower. You have to wait beyond the flower, but rat tail radish.
If you're waiting for the rat tail, you don't eat the radish.
Or the flowers. Or you won't get anywhere near the rat tail if you eat it all ahead of time. Anyway, the rat tail radish, and it's more and more available in seed catalogs. I don't think you can find them in stores around here, but
right. This is the thing. It's a real do-it-yourself thing. You cannot buy these things.
No. But look for them, because rat tail radishes are around. So that's something that's happening in backyards right now. Go out and enjoy. Something else that's happening in backyards. After one heck of a long winter, we've got spring and summer's just around the corner. The birds are back. And we've got a wonderful guest here in the studio with us today, Susan Benner, a longtime Ames resident, someone who knows how to look out a backyard window and recognize birds. She's got a good nose for birds.
A bird lover.
So welcome to the Donna Lena Kitchen, Susan.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be here, and I'm always happy to talk about birds. Unfortunately, we're kind of just past the migration time. Most of the migrating warblers are gone, but keep your eyes open because there may still be a few stragglers. So migrating warblers usually come through in the first couple of weeks of May, the early parts of May, and I haven't seen many anymore. But every spring, keep your eyes open because migrating warblers can land anywhere. Most of them fly from someplace in Latin America up to someplace north of us. We don't have many warblers that actually nest in Iowa, but we have a few. During their migration, generally they've got to land at night most of the time, or if the weather gets bad.
So they come in groups.
They come in groups, and they will usually, and they will come down wherever they have to, and that could be your backyard. So you'll see you can see some really interesting things during migration time that you might not see otherwise just in your backyard. But we do have three main warblers that do nest in Iowa. One is the American Redstart, which I do see in my yard occasionally. Beautiful birds. It's red and black.
Ooh.
Very striking, the male, of course. Tends to be a little more striking. And they're gorgeous little birds. The common yellow throat, which is the bandit bird, yellow with a black mask through the eyes.
I had to grab my bird book and look because I actually saw one of those this year. It looks like a little raccoon bird.
A little yellow raccoon bird.
Are warblers small or more mid-sized?
Warblers are small. Little birds.
Okay.
So we're definitely talking about small-sized birds. Once you see a common yellow throat, you'll never forget it. It's got this amazing black mask across the eyes. And then yellow warblers are another warbler that nests in Iowa. They're very common warblers all over the country, but they're beautiful. So they're mostly yellow. And they'll often have some reddish or rusty streaking on the breast. No eye ring, just this dark eye with this yellow face.
And do they warble?
Very pretty. They all warble.
Warble. Nice.
So these are some really striking birds that you might see in your yard. The yellow throats really like low bushes. They like marshy, damp kinds of areas, but they're often ones you can see easily because they lurk. They lurk in your bushes. Red starts tend to be higher and sometimes more difficult to find. Yellow warblers often are higher, too. But morning and evening are your best times to see birds. During the day, they're less active when it gets warm.
And what can one plant in the garden or the shrubbery that's really attractive for these?
Well, it all depends on what you're trying to attract. If you're trying to attract hummingbirds, which we can talk about because that's another really fun bird you can find oftentimes in your backyard, obviously flowers for hummingbirds.
Bright colors.
Mm-hmm.
Nasturtiums.
Like nasturtiums. You and the hummingbirds can fight for the blossoms.
They don't take very much.
They don't take much. And the hummingbirds, you can also attract them by feeding them yourself, getting a hummingbird feeder. It's always easy to find. The important thing to remember with a hummingbird feeder is, A, you need to change that nectar, the hummingbird nectar, on a regular basis, much more often than most of us want to.
Regular being, so, I've heard, almost
like
every day.
Every 2 to 3 days until it gets hot. Once you get much over 80 degrees, which we've been having already, you might want to change it every day. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is it can ferment. Or it can get
drunken
mold,
hummingbird,
and then you get
the
drunken hummingbird syndrome. And you know, it's not that good for their tiny little systems. Can't take much alcohol, and you can get mold and stuff in there, which is not good for them either. So you do want to wash those out. Keep, well, not just wash them out, but you want to using vinegar is one of the easiest way to clean them out because vinegar is very good at killing mold. And then,
sounds
of course,
to me
rinse
like it's
it.
Just easier to plant orange and red and pink flowers, right?
That may be the case. And you can – I've had luck with putting potted flowers on the table right out my window and getting hummingbirds coming around those. So that's really fun. Also, if you put your hummingbird feeder in the shade, it just helps decrease the amount of problems you can have with it fermenting and just getting too hot.
Are there many kinds of hummingbirds? I'm only familiar with hummingbirds because as I'm working in the garden, I hear this vroom right through my – and that must have been a hummingbird. These things will go by my ears. It's really tricky to see them. I see the ones with a ruby throat. Is that the Iowa
the
bird?
Only – basically the only kind of hummingbird that's native and nests in Iowa or the entire eastern part of the country is the ruby-throated hummingbird. We do sometimes get other hummingbirds that will stray from the west, especially during migration times. So every once in a while, something else and great fun will show up. But for the most part, what you see here is going to be the ruby-throated hummingbird. But they're pretty lovely, so we can't complain too much.
Do you know that the in some Native American traditions, the hummingbird is the totem for joy?
I think that's pretty
every time I see one, I just go, something joyful is happening.
They really are. They're just so much fun to see. Mm-hmm. And the way they move is just so cool to watch. They're just a real delight.
Oh, wonderful thing.
Another really gorgeous bird that is here now and does nest in Iowa and that we will sometimes see in our backyards are the Baltimore Orioles, which are gorgeous in there. The bright light orange and black, hard to miss. Now, they're more robin-sized as opposed to the small warblers or the teeny tiny hummingbirds. So your Baltimore Orioles are bigger, kind of robin-sized. You can attract those by putting out – some people will take an orange and halve it and put half of an orange on some kind of spike, and the Orioles like to come and –
oranges.
And eat the orange.
just because they happen to be the right color. I can understand
they
that.
They like fruit and they like that color. You can put out jelly for Orioles. And some people have trouble with Orioles getting into their hummingbird feeders. You might have
some
competition.
But what about, so I have gooseberry bushes and currant bushes. So who's going to come and feed off of those berries?
The berries are more likely to be cedar waxwings, for example, which are I've seen a bunch of those already this year, and they're beautiful. And they will often arrive in flocks and land someplace where there are berries, and this whole flock will then feed away for a while. They often travel in these flocks. So when you see one, you often see a bunch of them.
Uh-huh.
They're big berry lovers and really cool things to see doing that.
What are the cardinals eating right now?
Cardinals eat seeds, and they love sunflower seeds if you've put those in your bird feeder. They do some insects, but they're largely seed eaters, and you can tell because of that beak, if you look closely, that big seed-eating beak. And if you've ever been bitten by a cardinal, which I have been on a number of occasions, it really hurts.
This is a woman that is up close and personal. How did you get so close to a cardinal?
I do bird banding. I've been through several different bird banding courses through the Institute for Bird Populations, which does a lot of work, scientific work with birds. And so I now work with a group out of Grinnell, volunteer. This is not a paid kind of thing to do. And we band birds all summer. So you put up what are called mist nets. They're
like mist, M-I-S-T?
M-I-S-T, because they're – you can't really see them very well once they're up, which is the whole idea. The birds don't see the nets, and they fly into them and get caught. And then we come by and get them out of the net, which can be a tricky, tricky little procedure and take some time learning how to do it well. And
sounds nerve-wracking.
It is. When you start, it's just utterly nerve-wracking. After a while, you discover that it's it's not quite as traumatic as it appears. And then you band the bird and you look over it and take some statistics trying to determine, if you can, the approximate age of the bird within, whether it's a first-year bird, an after-first-year bird, or sometimes you can decide if it's a second-year bird or after-second-year bird. Certain ones like woodpeckers, because of the way they retain feathers, you can age them up to third year or after third year.
How long do birds live?
Boy, it really varies. And I don't have a good number, I have to say. But some species I know, woodpeckers in particular, I think blue jays and crows tend to live a very long time.
Very good. Speaking of birds being striking, unfortunately, sometimes the only way I can identify a bird is if it's run into my window. And one recently had done that, ran into my window and keeled over. There it laid. And beautiful bird, but I did have the opportunity to actually get out the bird book and identify it
because it wasn't going anywhere.
No, it wasn't going anywhere. And it was a brownish bird, speckly head, speckly bottom, and it had little red markings on its wings and tail feathers. And I found it was an oven bird.
An oven bird. Very cute little bird, which is actually a kind of warbler. It's not as brightly colored as a lot of the other, and that would be the fourth warbler that actually nests in Iowa.
The oven bird.
And they're very cute. They have little short tails and this little rufous cap on the top that kind of sticks up a little bit sometimes. So they are actually a warbler, but they walk around on the ground a lot. That's often where you'll see them.
Well, unfortunately, this one met its untimely end. But the bird books are always handy, and I'm glad I have many because I can kind of compare and contrast. Do you have any suggestions for good bird books?
I brought my favorite bird book with me today. I've got the Kaufman, that's Kaufman, Field Guide to Birds of North America. And the little word on here is the easiest guides for fast identification. And by God, that's just about the case.
it sounds like I better get one. I'm really never good with the bird book, and I always want to know.
I'm not sure quite what it is about the way the illustrations are done in this book, except my understanding is that he takes photos and then kind of retouches them so you can kind of catch all of the important aspects. If you're only going to have one book, like Lana said, sometimes it's nice to have a whole bunch of them and you can kind of cross-check and look around. This is a great book to start with, and it's a great book to have even when you're looking at a lot of books. Here's our oven bird, Lana. So does that look like what you saw?
There's my oven bird.
But I found this book really is a great one to if you're getting started. It's really easy to look through it and find the bird you just saw. And he gives you some helpful hints for things to look for. It's a field guide size, so not exactly put it in your pocket, but it's not heavy, it's not big, and you can put it in your backpack anyway.
Yep. Good thing to keep by your kitchen window.
So that, again, it's the Kaufman, Kaufman, Field Guide to Birds of North America. But also in terms of the window thing, you know, we all worry about those birds running into our windows, and there are a couple of things you can do. One is to put the silhouette of a hawk up on your window, and that'll chase the bird away from the window. Another thing is that actually putting your feeders closer to the window makes the bird see less reflection. And what happens is they see the trees behind them reflected in your window, and it looks like they can keep on flying, and bam, they run into the glass. So if you've got feeders, it's sometimes helpful to put those actually closer to your window to make it easier for the birds to recognize there's something there.
Bird safety.
Yeah. Bird safety 101.
That's good. And then how about the silhouette of a cat? Would that help? Live or
silhouette of a live cat might be helpful, especially if the window's open and they can hear the cat. Now, this will not make the birds feel comfortable using your feeder. But speaking of bird safety, the cat issue is a really big one. Domestic cats are the number two causes of destruction of songbirds. Number one is habitat destruction, but number two is actually domestic cats. And the number of songbirds that are killed by domestic cats is astounding. So if you have a cat, keep it inside. That's going to be, you can bell the cat, which helps some, but it's not going to keep it from getting birds all the time. So think about the birdies, and by all means, don't put up a bird feeder and then turn your cat outside.
give folks a fair chance here. That's good. Well, I want to thank you for sharing all the great stuff you know about birds, and we'll probably have you back because birds come and go, and we'll always have bird questions. Thanks to Susan Benner for coming.
Well, thanks a lot.
Donna Lana
Always
Kitchen.
Happy to talk about birds.
Great. Welcome back. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen here on KHOI Radio. That was a tune called The Ragtime Robin. We have been talking about birds, but now we're going to be talking about some real good stuff to eat.
Everyone's favorite summer dessert.
Yes.
Ice cream.
Ice cream, ice cream. Donna's had put in a real hard job of looking up ice cream recipes, making ice cream gelatos and sorbets. So tell us what you found out, Donna.
Well, I was just kind of refreshing my brain on the distinctions between, say, gelato and ice cream and the history of frozen desserts. It's obviously the Italians claim to have invented this. And then there are stories about Marco Polo coming in with flavored snow, all kinds of extravagant historical things. And apparently Thomas Jefferson was a huge ice cream fan.
Oh, it sounds like a Thomas Jefferson sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently he ran up a $250 ice cream bill at some point in some establishment. I think it was in Philadelphia or something. You know, I mean, this is American as it can be.
Scandal, scandal.
Yeah.
I love it. All
so,
right. Ice cream.
So, you know, people now talk a lot about gelato this and sorbet that. But the basic distinctions are ice cream and gelato are quite similar, except that ice cream usually has a little more air whipped into it, and gelato can actually be a little more flavor dense. So there's not a huge difference, you know, so don't be worried about making that distinction too much. And then sorbet, or as we used to call it when we were growing up, sherbet.
Yes, sherbet.
Same thing. Really, these are usually non-dairy based, fruit based.
That's why it's different than ice cream. Ice
that's
cream
right.
has got cream.
Uh-huh.
Sorbet or sherbet is not.
And gelatos can kind of be either.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's granita,
which is I'm going to give you a recipe for granita in a little bit, because granita is much more crystallized, and it's something you can make without an ice cream machine. So ice cream machines are – there's the old-fashioned crank with the salt kind that we used to have when we were kids.
Yeah, Stone Mountain, I believe they're called.
Something like that. Yeah. Of course, there's the electric version, or there's the hand crank version. And then in more recent times, we've gotten a lot of there are several kinds of, you know, kind of home kitchen ice cream makers. There's the kind where you have the bowl that's filled with it. Something that you put in the freezer and you freeze that, and then your mixture should be very cold before you plug that in. Otherwise, it won't be cold enough. Or I, fortunately, have a beautiful Italian electric ice cream machine, which is it makes about a quarter at a time, and you just plug it in, and it's got its own freezer unit in it, and it's
I've seen this
fail-proof.
This machine. It looks like. It looks like a little air conditioner sort of.
Yeah, it's about a foot and a half long.
Bigger than a bread box sort of thing.
Yes, and a little hefty.
Freezer and a little really classy looking kind of art deco almost.
Yeah, this was by the good grace of a client of mine, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Ah, I want to ask Don, how in the world did she get an ice cream machine from Michelle Pfeiffer? I believe this is the ever so famous person called Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes, well, you know, I was a private chef in Los Angeles for many, many years, and of course, the necessity to make things that were healthy, low in fat, and interesting in flavor. Meant that I actually made a lot of my clients had ice cream machines, so I got quite handy with it. It's a fast thing to use, especially when all you have to do is make some mixture and plug it in. So I think one of the things that Lana and I are going to do is we're going to have, at least during the summer, one ice cream or sorbet recipe every week. And
frozen dessert of the week.
Yes.
What do you have for us this week, Donna?
Well, we're gonna post on our website this particular recipe for coffee granita. Now the beauty of a granita is that it's granita. You do not need any sort of machine to make this.
Oh.
You just mix up a liquid. This one is coffee, and you put it either in. It just goes in the freezer. Like I make a mixture and put it like in a 9x9 Pyrex baking dish. And then you let it start to freeze around the edges and in the middle. And then you stir it with a fork.
Ah.
And I'm going to read you this recipe. It's from Gelato, Italian ice cream, sorbetti and granita. So a Sicilian classic coffee granita is wonderful, served in a fresh brioche, that's really exotic, on a hot day or as an after-dinner refreshment in small, elegant glasses. Now, one thing they don't say, I like to do this, is also serve it with whipped cream.
Oh.
And if you make the granita fairly sweet, then you don't sweeten the whipped cream. Or if you make the granita less sweet, like this recipe is not terribly sweet, then you can sweeten the whipped cream. Or you can sweeten both if you really want. But this one is you take 4 cups of hot, freshly brewed espresso or strong coffee, and you add 1/2 cup of sugar. And then it says, in a medium bowl, combine the espresso and sugar, stirring to dissolve the sugar. Set aside to cool. Pour into a 9-inch round or square baking dish, and you freeze until the mixture becomes slushy around the edges about 30 minutes. Then you stir, I use a fork, to break up the ice crystals, and you continue freezing, stirring the mixture every 20 minutes until it is slushy about 1 hour. That says mix 1 quart, serves 4.
Ooh, this sounds good. So perhaps setting a timer to remember to stir it.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah, and that's it's a loose timing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Freezers vary in temperature and, you know, whatever else you have in there. But the beauty of it is it's really easy to make. You can make it in kind of any flavor you want. You could just freeze orange juice and sugar or grapefruit and sugar.
It sounds like popsicles for adults.
Oh, yes. Well, popsicles are – it is – It really is. Popsicles are a whole other thing we'll have to get into.
You can find that recipe on the KHOI website, and that's www.khoifm.org. And you can go to the Donalana Kitchen section. And we've got all kinds of stuff posted there. We can't try to keep
and there'll be more. Keep
it. Yes, and there'll be more.
So that's going to be the recipe of the week for ice creams and sorbets and gelatos. Now, I have been making it with cold brewed coffee.
Oh, another good summer thing. I never think of cold brewed coffee, and I haven't made it in years. Tell us about cold brewed coffee.
And it doesn't have to be for the summer either. The beauty of the cold brewed coffee is that it's very low in acid. So for people with acid reflux problems or just who really want to be gentle in their digestive system but don't want to give up their coffee, this is a marvelous way to make coffee. I did buy a whole thing called a toddy system, and I used it a few times, and I found it a little bit cumbersome. So I've figured out that you can actually make it with a French press. So you just grind your coffee the way you usually would, nice and strong, not too fine, you know, just like you would with a French press, and you put it in the night before, or I've read you can leave it up to 48 hours. I'm going to try that next. That sounds really like it's going to be intense flavor, which is what you want, particularly if you're going to make a granita out of it. So you don't plunge it, though. And you don't, like with a regular French press, you pour the hot water in and then you plunge it. With this one, you pour cold water in, tap water, you know, room temperature water, basically, and then you just put it. You don't put the plunger down. You put the coffee in with the water. You set it in the refrigerator at least overnight, or I'll let you know how the 48-hour experiment goes, but at least overnight. And then once it's had a good 12 hours of steeping, it's kind of like making sun tea. You know how you do that? So then you plunge it. And then I've been able to – it lasts a week.
Oh,
flavor-wise, without getting funky or anything.
Then you put it back in the refrigerator. How much coffee? Then you just drink it as is, or you mix this with something?
Well, I drink my coffee with a lot of milk and no sugar. So I just get up in the morning, pour a little of the, coffee right out of the coffee pot that's been sitting in the refrigerator, and I just pour my milk in. These days it's been hot, so I've been drinking it cold. You can warm it up, of course, and that's why it's fine all year long, but you get really good flavor that way, and I think it's ideal for making granita.
Ah, granita. Granita cold brewed coffee. Yes,
yeah.
Let's give that a try.
Okay.
Oh, you also had a wonderful treat here that you shared with our dear engineer Rick, and he pronounced this a little confection, absolutely lovely. So tell us about
this. Okay, I want to encourage people, of course, always not to just follow recipes. So this one won't be on the web because this is like an oral tradition here. It was a cherry sorbet that I made last night. So in my little magic machine, I just pour in the ingredients. So here's what I did. I had some frozen tart cherries from Cindy Madsen.
Cindy Madsen is a farmer from southwest Iowa.
Yeah.
And she has an orchard and does all kinds of wonderful things.
So when cherry season comes, you can buy her products usually through Farm to Folk at the very least. So I was really ambitious and I bought 10 pounds last year because, cherries are so good for you. And it's also very hard to find tart cherries. You can find frozen, like Bing cherries and stuff like that.
Those are sweet cherries.
Yeah. These are real pie cherries, so to
tart
speak.
Cherries.
So, I put them in the blender because when they thaw, they juice out a lot. So I put them in the blender and ground them really, really fine. Then I poured it through a fine strainer to get all of the skins out. And then I ate the skins because I'm sure they contain really good nutrients. But it wouldn't have been the right consistency to put in the machine. So I added a bit of rhubarb syrup from last week's recipe. And then what else did I put? The thing you have to remember when you're flavoring for a cold dessert is that as things are colder, they must be a tad bit sweeter than they taste at room temperature because you lose some of that taste sensation as you're dropping the temperature. So I used agave syrup, which I often use because you can make a sugar syrup, but you just buy the agave and you pour it in and it makes really good texture. So I sweetened it to what I thought you know, because I still wanted it fairly tart. So I sweetened it with the rhubarb syrup and the agave. And then you all know that to make a cherry pie, you always put in a tad bit of almond extract. Not that you taste almond, but it's there as a note. So what I put into this was a little amaretto liqueur. And then I just put it all in the machine, pressed the chill button and the turn button, and, you know, half an hour, I had a beautiful, beautiful sorbet, bright red color, very Iowa cherries. And
we get a thumbs up from Rick over there.
Right. The other thing you have to do once you've made your ice cream in any sort of ice cream maker is you then put it in a container and you put it in the refrigerator, in the freezer, to kind of harden it off a little bit more before you want to serve it. So it's best to let it rest in the freezer, oh, an hour or two before you plan on serving it. And also, even though ice cream will stay in the freezer a long time, it does gather freezer flavor. So you need to cover these things very carefully and remember to eat them quite quickly.
Well, that's no problem. This was cherry sorbet, which was different than the granita, because granita, think of it as chunky popsicle.
And the
sorbet is like sherbet. Remember sherbet?
Right. Sorbet is smooth, and granita is crystally, more like a snow coney kind of thing, but deeper flavor because it's not actually ice.
Okay. One more thing. You have a heads up about adding liqueurs or liquors to
oh, yes. The one thing you have to be careful is alcohol content drops the freezing point. So don't put in so much that you're, unless you, of course, just want a chilled slushy or something like that. But you have to be careful adding alcohol so that it will still freeze. Now, usually you can add more than you think, but I'm sure there's some scientific, percentage of whatever you can add. But then, of course, different alcohols have different, you know, wine has a percentage of alcohol and different things, you know, like I'm sure if you wanted to put whiskey in, you'd have to put less.
Yes.
Because it's so high in alcohol.
So if it's not freezing, back off on the liquor or drink it with a straw. We'll take a little break. Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Donalana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. You've been listening to a little hammer dulcimer music from the musician Sam Rosetta. Always a nice addition to any talk about food, I think. Oh, yes. We're going to mention a few things that are going to be happening coming up in June. Practical Farmers of Iowa has put out its 2014 Field Day Guide. And the PFI Field Days are a wonderful way to connect up with your food. PFI Farmers...
It's not just for farmers.
No, it's not just for farmers. It's an invitation to anyone who's interested in all sorts of different topics here. These Field Days are hosted by individual farmers. Why? Because farmers are the experts on their farming systems and believe that sharing their knowledge, discoveries, and mistakes and successes benefits everyone. They invite the public onto their farms to learn about topics that span the agricultural spectrum and even the intersection about farming and local foods. So, Donna, tell us a little bit about what it's like at a field day.
Well, of course, every field day has a different topic according to, what the farmer is doing, what kind of farmer they are. I notice we've got coming up Tuesday, June 10th is which one is this? Sorry, Lonnie, you were... Oh, winter cereal rye cover crops, cash grain. Then another one is on-farm poultry producing, which is the Grimms in North English, Iowa.
One nice thing about these... PFI Field Days, everyone's welcome to come onto the farm. Like Donna just mentioned, learn about how to process your chicken. Learn how to see what it's like for your chicken to get from feather to plate. But they're also on the farms all around Iowa. So you get a chance to get out your map and find out exactly where all these little towns are.
Well, there's one... this is at the Grafunes Farm, which is actually just between Ames and Ankeny, very easy to get to. And it's Craig and LaVon Grafune, and this one is about hoof hair and feather care for livestock. They have the most beautiful Charolais, which is a big white beef cattle. And also, Craig is growing the corn that's being processed by the brand name, it's an Iowa local corn that's now available frozen year-round.
Corn for people.
Yeah, right. Sweet corn. And it's delicious. Really, really delicious. They freeze it. They harvest it off and flash freeze it. And it's the best tasting frozen sweet corn I've ever had. It really, really is.
And if somebody else wants to do it besides me in my kitchen, that's fine with me.
Yeah, you don't have to scrape it off the cobs yourself. And this can be found, I know they have it at Weisfield, they have it at, I think, Fairway, and they even have it at...
Hy-Vee?
Yeah. It's red. And they're also doing apples, the same company. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the brand name, but look for it in your frozen vegetable case. So that is going to be at the Grafunes on June 19th. Then there's Cool Bots and Bees, walk-in coolers and pollinators. And this is... Jill and Sean, Jill Bebot and Sean Skihan, and this is at Blue Gate Farm on June 22nd. I'm just picking out the ones that are, I think, a little foodie for us. You don't have to be a farmer to enjoy
Learn
this.
About bees. Even if you're not a farmer, walking through a field with the farmer that is managing the pasture or growing the crop, you'll be surprised what you learn. And one nice thing about this is that usually a light lunch is served.
Yeah.
Usually these things are free. Mm-hmm. There may be a small charge for something if they give away things or if there is a more of a substantial dinner. And for further information on upcoming practical farmers events, especially these field days that are open to any of you who are interested to find out where your food comes from, you can contact the PFI office.
www.practicalfarmers.org. Farmers.org. Okay.
Yes, yes.
We're still talking about ice creams and frozen desserts, so I wanted to clarify a little bit that you do not need a fancy machine like I am fortunate enough to have and get to play with. But there are varying levels of, you know, you can do the granita with no investment at all in your freezer, basically, which most of us have at least a small freezer in our refrigerator. And or you can buy these kind that usually run about $50 where you pre-freeze the bowl. And those work very well as long as your mixture is extremely cold to start with. You can also often find those at garage sales or yard sales.
I have one, a small pink one that you freeze, and it has a little handle on it that actually has a little handle that stirs the stuff
up. Oh, so it's not electric.
Put it in the freezer, take it out, turn it, put it back in the freezer. My only complaint with that is that it makes too small amount at a time.
I've even seen these sort of inflatable balls that you put the mixture in and the kids toss them back and forth. Never actually used one, but it does seem like a fun thing to do because kids always like to make ice cream. Or you can do the traditional kind with the salt pack. And those you can often find at auctions or used. Or you can use the fancy kind that I am fortunate enough to have. But don't get hung up on the machinery. It's really what you put in. So we'll post that granita coffee recipe, and then we'll post every week we're going to have throughout the summer a frozen dessert. Another chilled dessert that I wanted to talk about today, and we'll put this recipe on the web as well, is panna cotta, which is not frozen, but it's chilled. And basically what panna cotta is, and you'll see it on restaurant menus and stuff, but I have to tell you guys, it's so easy to make. Don't ever bother to buy it at the restaurant. Just make it yourself. It's basically, in American speak, it's frozen vanilla or chilled vanilla jello is what it is. So it's a gelatin-based dessert, and the recipe is I'm going to post my version on. It's a half a cup of sugar, 2 cups of heavy cream, and be careful not to buy the cream with additives. And often heavy cream here does. So do not boil it. Just bring it to a simmer. So it's 2 cups of heavy cream, a cup of whole milk, and then the unflavored gelatin, which is either one envelope if you're buying the Knox kind plus a teaspoon or 4 teaspoons. And this can be put into individual cups. It can be molded like Jell-O and then unmolded and served. Basically, you put the sugar, the cream, and the milk in a saucepan. You turn the heat to medium-high, and you stir it and remove it just before it boils. And while it's hot, you drizzle the gelatin in it, and you continue to stir. What you're doing is blooming the gelatin into the mixture. And then you let it cool. And then as it's a little bit cooler, you pour it into your ramekins. Or I've even just put it into, like, a baking dish and then kind of scooped it out. You know, like if you're having a lot of people and,
you cut it into squares.
Yeah.
And so this ends up looking like a very creamy, white little dessert. I had a panna cotta as a dessert at the rather new restaurant, Plus 39, here in Ames. It was a panna cotta, and it was made with goat's milk, and it was quite lovely.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good little thing.
I think a good way to, like, I just found a new cheese at Wheatsfield. It's from Honey Creek, Iowa. And it is a goat and sheep's milk cheese mix. So it's a little denser than your normal goat cheese, you know, but it's still a fresh cheese. And it's, you know, this is an unflavored one. But the company is called Does and Divas Dairy Incorporated. And it says goat and sheep milk products. So if you wanted to make a goat milk panna cotta, this would actually be a goat and cheese. I would take a package of this and kind of measuring it to fit this recipe somehow. The idea is to get the right proportion of gelatin to liquid. I would probably take a package of this and put it in either the blender or the Cuisinart and get it really finely blended with some milk or cream, depending on how rich you want it.
So this is not a softer sort of cheese? It's a soft cheese?
Yeah. It's a fresh cheese. So you would just blend it up into some kind of liquidy thing and then follow the panna cotta. I will make an experiment with this cheese this week, and we'll post a recipe so you can have a goat's and sheep milk panna cotta.
And maybe we can press Rick in for another taste test.
Yes.
This is good.
So I would encourage you to make panna cotta. You can serve it with fruit. You can vary the fat content by, if you are really on a diet, you can make it with 2% milk. Now, it's not going to be quite as unctuous as if you're making with all of that cream, but it is refreshing. It is really easy. Children seem to like it. I can't tell you. You just got to try it. You won't believe how easy it is.
Ice cream, panna cotta, gelato, sorbet, what's not to like? We're thinking of celebrating summer, and with there's all kinds of fruit and things coming, fruit, dairy, just plain sugar and good stuff, and we'll make frozen desserts. And look for our frozen dessert of the week coming up. We want to thank our special guest, Susan Benner, for talking about birds today. That was nice. We learn things. This is good. See, anything else you want to say about ice cream?
No, but I'm going to go home and try this new panna cotta with goat and sheep cheese.
That's lovely.
So we'll report back to you on that one. And do try the granita. And it doesn't have to be coffee. I just want to empower you that just with your fork and your freezer, you can make something delicious and very light to eat.
Go for it. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen Show with Lana Nachtigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Remember Art Walk this coming weekend. That's on Friday. Also, Scandinavian Days are this weekend in Story City. So take that in.
Yum.
I'm sure there's all kinds of... Let's go up there and eat some Scandinavian.
Yeah, and if you're going up to Story City, say hello to our friends at the new Story City Locker. I think I might have to go up and get some of that Braunschweiger.
More things to eat. Tune in next week for more. And this is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Local flavor.
Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.